His majesty is castling of one small corner. He's still the king. Familiar spaces are reshaping. Dark horse forces are closing in. Contrast, blur the lines and the die is cast. Kept in check by your checkered past. One step forward, two steps back. No place to retrace your tracks. When the picture's out of whack, you'll compare and contrast.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Brandon Adamson. We're going to be discussing his new EP, Compare and Contrast. Brandon, great having you back on the show.
Hey, guys.
Brandon, how long have you been making music? You told me you started back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I'd say that's about right. About maybe like 1993, 95 or so is when I started actually recording stuff. Initially, I got into music because my a lot of my friends in high school and stuff were in like these in the 90s. They were in like ska bands and things like that, and I was kind of jealous of them. And it wasn't until a while later when I discovered like a lot of like indie musicians that were basically just, recording themselves on their own, that I realized that like I could just record albums on my own, that I didn't have to be in a band. Cause I was in like a punk band, like very briefly, which, went absolutely nowhere. And then the people were like, complete drug addicts. And one of them later like died of a drug overdose. These were like kids I went to high school with. I tried to look him up a few years ago, and I found out that he died like 15 years ago. So I started in Phoenix recording just in my room. Like I bought like a 4-track, and I recorded a lot of songs. I recorded an EP back then called Birthday Boy, which was just like a really shitty like lo-fi recording.
So this was kind of like the early days of internet music.
totally the early days. Like, it was even like initially like released on cassette. But it was just like the shittiest recordings. And I would like, and this is like the 90s. So like, this is how, how much more innocent that time period was, is what, like I would write songs about like, characters on like TV shows and stuff like Melrose Place, and I would write about that kind of thing because I had I was living in Phoenix and I had an apartment, and like I had like just turned 18 and moved away, and like I didn't know anyone, so I had really nothing to write songs about except for like these people on these like cable shows and whatnot. And I would actually I'd take these shitty cassettes, right, and I would send them out. Like, I would mail them to, like, major labels, like Warner Brothers and things like that. And I would just mail them out everywhere. And I would even get, like hate mail sometimes, like, especially for, like, some of these, like, indie labels. Like, how dare you send us this shit or whatever. So, I don't know. But, yeah, I just think it was really ridiculous because at that time I was taking cassettes, and I would, I was mailing them to like Hollywood Records and all of these, like, these huge things that you're not even supposed to be considered at these companies unless you have like, like an agent and a manager, and you've been, touring for years. At least like back then, that's how it was supposed to work. Now, if you just like make like a viral YouTube video, like you can probably get something going. But back then, I was just doing that, but part of it, I was just doing it because I thought, like, I just pictured in my mind, like, what the reaction would be when they would get these cassettes,
Yeah, you did it more for the music. Did you have that kind of stereotypical cliche fantasy that a lot of teenagers and like early 20-somethings have of being like a famous musician?
Yeah, I totally did, but I always like, but the odd thing is that like I never really made anything good or really interesting until like until I stopped caring about that kind of stuff, you know, because when you look back and you're a teenager, it's not even so much that like you, you know, you want to be like famous and all that. It could just be that like, you know, it's like your world is so much smaller then. So it could just be like, you know, you might like one girl or something and think that it's going to impress her or something like that. But, you know, now, like, you know, whatever, you know, whatever, like, a person, like, I thought that I was going to, like, you know, get back at by being successful or something, you know, now they're, like, they're totally obese and forgotten or they're, like, dead or whatever. It doesn't, you get to a point when you're just, like, you know, you forget what long ago, like, why you even cared. But I think it was also a creative outlet for me because I had like wanted to make movies when I was younger, and it was just something where like you just couldn't really just get right into, you know, it needed a lot of money and things like that, especially back then. And then you also it wasn't like now where you can just like you know, film something like a video camera cost like, you know, $800 or something, you know, back then. So it wasn't like, which was like just a huge amount of money. That would be just for like a crappy, like, video camera that you couldn't do anything with really. So I wanted to do movies and like, I just like making music was just kind of like a creative outlet mostly for, my writing. And I record tons of stuff. Most of it just like, most of the recordings were lost over the years. And then I managed to, find a copy of Birthday Boy and I re-released it. And it's like just the shittiest thing ever. But like, so
is
other
there
people
a
have
copy,
liked it just,
accessible online?
Oh yeah, there definitely is. And I think like one of the songs is called Right Back Where I Started, but it's like the entire recording is like it's about the life of like the character Michael on Melrose Place, but which for whatever reason I was like fascinated with.
That's kind of Melrose Place. I mean, I've heard of that. I remember hearing about that show as a kid. I don't think I've watched a single episode. But why not like a show like Seinfeld? Why'd you pick that out of all shows?
Because I lived in like these really like seedy apartments. Like when I got my first apartment, I was just like, I was living in Phoenix. I was like so excited to just get any apartment. Like, you know, like I was just excited about the first one that I went into to rent, even though like it wasn't in a cool part of town. It was just like, it was ghetto. And they only had, all they had was basic cable. So all they had was, you know, the regular channels, and then for the cable, all they had was the Family Channel and like the E Channel and C-SPAN. So I would watch the E Channel, and the E Channel at that time showed reruns of Melrose Place every day, like twice a day. And so I got like hooked on it because I had nothing else to do. And like, I didn't have a lot of friends here because I had moved here. And I, you know, so I just got to, I got hooked on and I started like writing songs about it. And they also showed reruns of like these 70s shows like WKRP in Cincinnati and One Day at a Time, Alice. And that was kind of also where I got like really hooked on being interested in the 70s. So some of like that stuff was influenced by like a lot of those theme songs and whatnot from those, because I just heard them constantly because that was like all I did was watch that channel.
You know, I can totally relate because 3 years ago I had my first apartment and I was living right in the center city of Philadelphia, and I lived right next to this train that would wake me up like at 6 in the morning or 7, and it would finally end at like 1 in the morning. drunk, so I had this weird, like, schedule, and it was, like, also I heard, like, gunshots at night, but my room was so small, and pretty much all I did was just watch, like, classical anime and, like, tell my girlfriend to come over, like, every, you know, Saturday or Friday, and that was, like, the best part of the week. You know, after it's like, oh, my girlfriend's coming, I'm not alone. And the other times I would be like doing really weird loner stuff, like eating out at like a fried chicken place, or like going to one time I saw like a jazz concert for free. And then like I went to go in the theaters and watch this like obscure Japanese film. Like it's really weird if you like live on your own and you're young. And ironically, during that time, I was like, you know what? I should start making music on my synthesizer. And basically what I came up was the original Pizza Dog Studios recording, which I actually released on my Bandcamp, the trashcore.bandcamp.com, and I talked to Robert about it. And it was basically synthesizer songs about Brave Little Toaster, The Hobbit from like 1970-something, because I was like watching those, or Mario Kart 64, and I could totally relate to where you were at that time. I don't know.
So, Brandon, would you say, was this the beginning of the sort of genre of indie music?
I would say so, because it was, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's the beginning, because it always kind of existed, but I think that it was definitely kind of that weird 90s era where people would just make, like, weird recordings, like Homer, like Daniel Johnston and that kind of stuff. And it was actually, like, listening to some of that stuff is when I realized that, like, wow, like, because before that I had thought that, you know, in order to, you know, put out a CD or anything, like, it had to be, like, professionally recorded a certain way. And then, like, I found all of these, like, indie albums and stuff and was reading about them, like, in zines and whatnot, that they were just, like, recorded, like, on 4-track. And I was just, like, so amazed that, like, oh, you know, you mean you could record something and just like on anything, and you could get it released, like, and that was just like, that just like totally opened up my world, because before that I saw my friends that were like paying, you know, for these big recording studios and stuff for their bands, and I just thought, like, well, you know, I'm never going to get to that. And then I realized that you could just that there were people just releasing it on the same stuff that people would record demos on and things like that.
With your music, you do the vocals and you also do the synth and the keyboard. Do you also play guitar or any other instruments?
Yeah, I play like the guitar, especially on my newer recordings. But the old stuff from the 90s was all like, you know, vintage keyboards and things like that, well, from like Radio Shack, you know, Target and places like that. But the newer stuff is more like, as I got older, I saved up and I bought more like legit, like vintage synths and organs and things like that from, you know, from the 70s. And I do have like a couple of electric guitars and acoustic guitars, and I actually have the electric guitar, which is the main one that I use, which was actually from when I was a kid, because I didn't mention this before, but when I was a kid and the movie Back to the Future came out, some kids from my class and I, like, we decided to form a band, like, after seeing Back to the Future. And this was in like 1985 and 86. And so we formed this band that was like just these kids, like, you know, jamming on guitars, and like we had no idea what we were doing, but we actually played a show at the school. And in the yearbook from that year, it says Stars of the Future, and there's like a picture of us jamming there. And I don't know if you've seen Back to the Future, but there was a, you know, he does a song in the movie called Johnny Be Good, you know, that.
Oh yeah,
song?
The scene where he goes back in time and plays in the 50s. I mean, that scene's been parodied in so many different films and TV shows.
Right. Well, we actually did, you know, the original parody, which, you know, which we weren't even smart enough to realize was a parody. But there was a kid in the band named Carrie. So we just did that same song, but we called it Carrie Be Good. and that was the drummer. And he actually used my, I had a Fraggle Rock drum set when I was a kid, and like I let him use that. And you know, and then I had this guitar, which I thought was like a really, you know, radical guitar, but really it was just, you know, some guitar from like 1970 or something that, like, you know, my uncle just gave to me. It was missing a string, but I actually had it restored a few years ago, and that is like my main guitar that I use. But I'm not really very good at guitar, but I can play enough chords and things like that to write songs. I can kind of play most you know, most instruments a little bit, but I'm not like super proficient at them. My main like skill or whatever is in like writing the lyrics and writing the songs.
Is most of your work solo, or is some of this collaboration with a band? So if it's solo, you record each instrument and the vocals and you lay them over each other, or do it mostly at once?
I record each instrument separately, and I do it all myself, but I have in the past, I had like a producer guy who I used to work with who would help me do mixing and stuff. And then occasionally he would like, he would play on some songs or, you know, add some kind of, you know, synthy effects or whatnot, because, you know, I was always doing things like a very kind of like old school, like very, like the most like organic way, like the way that you're like not supposed to do things, you know, like I was just always very stubborn, and I would just be like, oh, you know, who cares if you're not supposed to record under these conditions or whatever? Like, I just want it to sound like, you know, I just want to buy this old Radio Shack microphone and use that.
I noticed with your recent album, Compare and Contrast, it's your voice, but it sounds like multiple voices overlapping. Did you do something in the editing that makes it sound that way?
No, that's actually a very easy trick. Like, you just sing, the lyrics on more than one track, you know, and then so when you mix them, it's like it gives it like a chorus kind of effect.
Yeah, it does. With the chorus, you record one track and then you just edit them, layer them over each other on the editing software.
Yeah, exactly, because I use like an 8 or a 16 track digital recorder, like a physical recorder. And then I have some old like four-track machines, also analog. So I have like a very kind of, old school, very kind of ghetto setup. I like to do things that way. And then eventually, like, you know, you have to input it into some kind of program, like Pro Tools or Audacity or something, to finish the mixing and to clean up the audio a little bit.
Audacity is what I use to record my shows, but I mean, it's pretty basic. I didn't know it was, you'd recommend it for music as well.
I mean, only if you, it's like the shittiest, you know, of those kind of programs you can get. It's free, but I just mean like at a certain point, you know, you have to, you have to translate things like into the digital world, you know, so that you can release them and get them into spec. It's good for that. And it's also, there are actually a lot of plugins that you can get for that, which makes it into a more legit, you know, a machine for mixing and things like that. If you just do it, use it on its own, like basically quote, like out of the box, and then it pretty much, it's pretty useless. But there are a lot of plugins and whatnot, because I guess over the years there's been a lot of nerds and what has created these great plugins that have actually made it into like a useful program. So I would actually probably use that over
it's
a lot of these,
because
these other programs.
I was a huge fan of Unread Records. There's this guy named Chris Fisher, and I had him on my podcast on my YouTube channel, and he's all for the ideal of sounding deliberately shitty as possible, and he calls his music hard twee, where, you know, he'll get like a tape recorder and, you know, from Radio Shack and just record it as like the fan is going on. It'll just be a guitar and some like weird lo-fi. And I love that lo-fi genre. It's definitely something unique that came from the 90s and is still, it still has its niche today. I just think it's more kind of in the punk scene, or at least it has its own, maybe Portland, Oregon niche, I would say. There's this kind of area by area, it's very different, and trends come and go. And I think today, electronic music, that if some like yuppie or hipster has like a MacBook Air and he's got Reason 9, you know, he could just record music onto that. And it's just, it sounds almost, you know, what you thought would be impossible to make 20 years ago now could be made in like an hour or two, which I think is amazing. And that media has to be looked at today, you know. That's why there's so much vaporwave tracks today. You just get a sample and you slow it down and then you upload it on YouTube and it goes viral.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, like, I was always, I think, like, wanting to recreate certain sounds and experiences. So, like, I would want to, you know, use certain instruments and certain, like, you know, recordings, because I was trying to recreate some other experience from my earlier life. Like, even, like, if I was just like nostalgic for like when I used to record on 4-track in my room, I would be like, oh, I just want to record on 4-track now. And it's just like the whole experience to me is more than just the music, really. And it's also because the my influences are all stuff that were like in the 60s and the 70s, like a lot of those old, like, you know, folk singer songwriters, like people like Jake Holmes, and a lot of the bands of the 60s, like, you know, mod bands. Like, I was never into.
So you never were really interested in the major bands like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan? You were more interested in like the obscure and forgotten bands?
Yeah, because I always related more to, like, I didn't relate to bands like the Beatles because they were just so huge. It's just like, you know, I related to these other bands that like never quite made it. They were always obscure. Like, their recordings were, you know, they just, for whatever reason, you know, maybe they had like one song that was like kind of a hit, but I was always just obsessed with those kind of bands because I felt like I could relate to them more, and their recordings were, you know, a lot of them weren't as good quality. And I kind of related to just their experiences.
Were the bands you were the most into the British mod sound mostly?
Yeah, the British mod sound, but I would say like, that's probably like a lot of what I like the most is like 60s mod. But I also can't deny the fact that, you know, that we all have influences that are kind of maybe outside of our control. I think that you can hear a lot of in my music. You can hear a lot of my influences, I think, were music from like commercials, from like Saturday morning cartoons. Like, somebody once told me that like I should make
mostly the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, the 80s for sure, because I was just obsessed in the 80s with like Saturday morning cartoons and just like 80s culture and 80s TV. Like, I was just like one of the most like 80s kids. Like, just like, if you ever watched like, you know, like an 80s kid movie or something, and like the kid is like this like really imaginative, you know, kind of like weird outcast, like that was totally like my experience as like an 80s kid. And I had like, you know, I was just obsessed with like Saturday morning cartoons and just 80s like, you know, playing with like you know, action figures and things that you just associate with these 80s kids. Like, if you've ever seen the film Cloak and Dagger from the 80s, like, I would say that I could really relate to that child. It was like almost exactly like I was when I was a kid, like pretending to be like a secret agent, like your walkie-talkies and like playing guns. You know, that's that was my experience. And so I feel like a lot of despite like what we like or what we claim to be our influences, I think that I was influenced by a lot of that stuff. And then also just, you know, the stuff just gets so ingrained in you, those jingles and whatnot. Like I can still remember like, you know, like the theme song from like Juicy Fruit commercials and, you know, Hungry Hungry Hippos and things like that, Toys R Us. So that stuff just gets burned into your brain, and I feel like it influences you. So like the song Something Fun, a Trampoline, that's on my new EP, is kind of a good example of that. It almost has like, is reminiscent of like that Mentos commercial, but that's kind of like the stuff I grew up listening to.
With your latest EP, my impression of it is that the influences are from, I noticed the influences from both the 60s mod bands, but also the 90s mod revival bands and the kind of the 90s indie rock sound. It's kind of influences by all those.
Yeah, which in the 90s, like in like 1999 or 2000, I saw a band when I was living in West Hollywood. They were called Majestic or Majestic 12. They changed their name a couple times, but they were kind of an indie 90s band that was like kind of that, you know, they were influenced by the British like mod sound. And I saw them like just once when they were playing in West Hollywood, and they never, like they released a bunch of stuff, but they never quite made it as big, you know, as their other contemporary bands. And but I never forgot them. So like, I still would listen to them for years and years, even after I left Hollywood. And they were like, definitely a big influence on me. They had an album that was called Wake Up, Come Out and Play, which is just has a really kind of 60s and 70s upbeat sound.
When you lived in West Hollywood, did you perform at any of the clubs in the Sunset Strip?
No, I didn't. I wasn't doing music at the time. Like when I lived out there, I was mostly just like, just kind of like, you know, just partying. Like that was what I was like just doing, and not partying like the cliche, like doing like drugs and stuff like that. But I just mean like, you know, I had friends out there, and you know, we would just like, you know, like waste the day all day, like just like eating at like Baja Fresh and just like laying around listening to records. And then we would go out, you know, to some parties like in Malibu or Pacific Palisades or something like that. And we would just like, you know, not go to bed until like 8 a.m. the next day. And we would just like talk about the girls we liked and things like that. And then, but so when I was out there, I was mostly just like, into like I was into acting, and I did like a few commercials, like I was in a commercial for two commercials for Gap, and one of them like I was able to find online, which is still out there, but I have no idea what happened to the other one. They were shot at Universal Studios, and then I did I was an extra in like a bunch of different movies and TV shows, like I don't even remember, but I was mostly doing that for the money. But I didn't really enjoy acting because, you know, I grew up the kind of movies that I grew up watching and like wanting to be in and like being interested in being an actor. Like when I actually lived in West Hollywood, I realized that like those kind of movies weren't being made anymore. And like the kind of stuff they were making was like not stuff
I
would ever.
Still the 90s you're talking about, or the, or like the early 2000s,
like 1999 and 2000, maybe to up to 2001 is that's when, but when I was living out there, I didn't think, I just came to the conclusion that the kind of movies they were making were like not the kind of stuff that I would ever want to be in. And since I left, it only got worse, you know, like reality TV took off, and the kind of movies that come out now are all of these, like, these weird, like digital animation things, or the, you know, comic book superheroes, or like movie remakes. Like they were kind of starting big on those movie remakes back then. And I was already like, you know, this sucks, 'cause they were remaking like Planet of the Apes. back then. And I was just like, look, this is, you know, even when I would like, you know, get the chance to audition for stuff, I just realized that, like, you know, I would never want to be in any of this stuff. So, and I also just, I didn't like that. You have, you know, no control, like, 'cause when you're like, you know, recording music or something, you could be like, all right, well, I don't like that. I'm just going to delete that and put it out. But if you're like in a movie or something and like you have no control, like you could look like you have leprosy in a scene or something, and then you can't, like, there's nothing, it's out there. There's nothing you can do.
What do you think about the direction of the indie music scene? How has it changed? Do you think the genre is dead?
Well, it's not really dead. I noticed that, like, the, you know, just, it's a lot different in the sense that there aren't really the same kind of avenues to promote and whatnot. Like, when I was younger, it was all laid out, you know, like you had to go, you know, play out and get some press and just like, and then tour. Like, now it's not so much like that anymore. There are a lot more avenues to actually release your music, but because those are available to everyone, then it's much more difficult to, you know, to stand out or anything. And as far as like the indie music scene, I don't think that a lot of it is more geared towards like electronic stuff now. Like, even for like the, where you see people like promoting their music, like on all these different sites, you know, it's all like the promotions are tend to be centered around like DJs and things like that. It's totally different. And I noticed when I went to South by Southwest, like 5 or 6 years ago, that there was a lot more of like,
is that the music festival in Austin?
Yeah, in Austin, there was a lot more electronic stuff, and I don't know, it's just completely different. I think that it's just, it's also the style has changed. I don't think that that teenagers today are really as quote, indie in general. I think that they're all using the same stuff. They're all kind of part of the same culture.
Yeah, they're normies. Because,
yeah, you know what I mean? Because, like, well, a good example of, you know, when I was younger or something, the, you know, the people who would have used a certain social media site, like, you know, like Makeout Club or things like that, like, they would be of a certain, like, type of person that would just
so
be using
that.
So this
was even before MySpace?
Yeah, before that. But now if you talk to people, like, you know, everyone uses everything, you know, like everyone uses Facebook or Twitter, you know, or, you know, not everyone, but you know what I mean? Like, there's less of this, you know, this kind of, these people that are like outsiders. And now, like, people listen to also like almost every kind of music too, you know, like the same people will be like, you know, let's go to this, this rave, or this, you know, EDM festival, are the same people who are like, yeah, let's go to like Country Thunder, you know, instead of something like that. It's
yeah.
Totally like,
I noticed that too. Like, I went back in the 90s. I've always noticed this, the scene, the genre for electronic music for the normie was called techno. And they basically would smear it off as that weird European rave culture out to kill the baby boomers. And now today it's like, now they, it's commodified, and they call it, you know, electronic dance music, and they listen to douchebaggy electro music all made on dubstep. Like, dubstep has to be almost the death of all rave oriental or oriented electronic music. It's just, I don't like it either. And I think that there's been these, I do realize things have became more sweppel, stuff white people like, from Witch House to C-Punk and all this stuff, which I don't like at all. I just think the normie has realized electronic music is a norm, However, they're quite unaware of how to still operate electronic music, even though there is ways to make electronic music. I don't know. It's this strange thing going on. It's very pretentious when somebody says, "Oh, I'm going out to a vampire industrial night," when the next night they'll change their mind and say EDM ambient. That's so stupid and pretentious. It's like, you know, you can't have, it's consumerism, really.
Yeah, and it's much harder now, I think, to kind of escape into doing your own thing, like, because you know, back then, like when I was younger, like, you know, we didn't even really have, you know, online, you know, like, so it's like someone joked about this to me the other day when, like, we were talking about going to malls and stuff. We were like, yeah, like, you used to have to, like, work to make friends. You know, you couldn't just, like, go online and just start fucking chatting with people. You know, like, it was like, you know, like, there were periods where, you know, you wouldn't necessarily talk to somebody on the phone for, like, months or hang out with anybody, especially, like, when I first moved to Phoenix. I mean, I pretty much grew up here, but, you know, I lived out here in the summers with my grandparents. But when I first, like, moved out here, like, I was just, like, yeah, I don't think I hung out with anyone for, like, the first, like, you know, 4 or 5 months.
When you first moved to Phoenix, was there any kind of a cultural scene?
Yeah, there definitely was. It was just, I was actually in the 90s, like, Tempe had, like, a really big music scene. Like, bands like the Gin Blossoms came from here, and it had a really thriving scene. And in fact, like, since I've lived here, like, there's been countless, like, articles, like, about, like, you know, how are we going to bring that back or something like that. It's like almost every year there's some kind of, like, thing is how they're going to revive that, because it was kind of like Seattle in a sense. Like, Tempe was, like, had a really thriving scene here. It wasn't quite as big, like, it didn't quite make it, but almost anyone remembers it. And they always, like, write these articles about how the, you know, how corporations have kind of, you know, ruined these old places where there used to be a thriving music scene by, like, you know, tearing down these establishments and putting in, like, a Jamba Juice or something.
Can you comment on the album cover for Compare and Contrast? You have this drawing. It looks kind of like it could be, like, a fast food place, and you have your picture there. I get the feeling that it was definitely influenced by the 70s. Can you comment on the design as far as, like, aesthetics go? Do you prefer the more 60s mod look, or the more psychedelic look that came out from the later part of the 60s for design?
Well, I prefer more of the mod, but not, like, really over the top. I guess I like kind of more that, you know, sort of like 70s, like, advertisement.
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking of, though. Definitely, you know, the one, Popsicle Stand, which came out 2 years ago, reminds me of a 70s advertisement.
Yeah, so I tend to just, like, go through and look at advertisements and just kind of, like, I kind of try to look at things and see, like, you know, would this font or would this imagery or design, like, would it seem really out of place there or something like that? And then that's what I kind of go by. The cover, it kind of inspired somewhat by the cover for Majestic's album called Live It Up, which, if you look it up, you could kind of see how the inspiration was there. And also there was, like, a girl that I used to know that used to always, like, make these images like that, where she would do, like, a cutout of herself and put her with or her friends or something, and put, like, on a solid color background, and she'd have all these different colors and these different images with her, along with, like, some weird you know, animals or something like that. And it was just very kind of, I always liked the look of it. So I kind of, it was kind of a combination.
You told me you weren't as crazy about the whole hippie subculture. Do you like the psychedelic design and artwork?
I don't really like the stuff from after 1967, like the whole... I do like some of the music, you know, from that era, like Jefferson Airplane, you know, Surrealistic Pillow, and that kind of stuff. Like the music is good, but I'm not into that whole like really like
album cover designs.
No, it's just like a lot of it is just like a lot of that is like the too like zany and like over the top. It kind of reminds me of like Austin Powers and stuff, kind of like
how
when they recreated that stuff in the 90s. I like that stuff, but you know, I like the Austin Powers in that, but it was kind of like, it made it like, it was too like cartoonish, you know, the way that, you know, with like the bell bottoms and just like all of it, it's just kind of like a little too zany and like dirty. Whereas I liked more like the, more of like the space age aesthetic and, then like I was never all about like the you know the drug scene or you know all of that.
When I look at your logo you use for altleft.com, it reminds me more of the logos you see that were used on 80s shopping centers. Was that the inspiration for that logo?
Yeah, I would say that it was. I mean, it was just part like that logo or whatever. It just comes with the WordPress theme. So
you didn't actually design that. You just picked it from
where? No, I didn't design it. But of course I picked it for that reason, you know, so that the, because I don't know, I'm very particular about that kind of thing. So that was like, I think I actually paid for that theme just because it had that aesthetic. But I saw it more as kind of like the, like a Logan's Run kind of look, which, you know, which was filmed basically in a mall, so that makes sense.
You were saying that you actually would like to live in a society like Logan's Run. I guess most people view it as kind of a dystopian, obviously with a theme, but just based on that aesthetic, you've actually talked about building cities based on the kind of mall model, and you see the aesthetic of Logan's Run as your ideal utopian society.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I wish that they would, you know, instead of, I watch a lot of these, you know, these like dead mall videos on YouTube, like, you know, the ones that Dan Bell does and stuff, mm-hmm. like me and my girlfriend watch, because I was always, ever since I can remember, I've always been always been a mall rat, because I was a kid in the 80s and, you know, I had like a very like 80s mom, you know, who would just go to the mall all the time. You know, I'd have to just like spend hours there with her. Like, you know, she was like a total like if you've ever seen the show Dynasty, you know, like I was like my mom, like going to the mall and like, you know, I grew up drinking like Diet Pepsi and Tab, Diet Coke, things like that. I was like raised on that stuff. So I was just always like a mall rat when I got in, you know, high school, even when other people were just like, oh, like, you know, because even back then people were like, oh, gross. Like, I hate the mall, you know, like, but I would still always love going to the mall, you know, and I just go all the time. And
didn't you write an article about that mall in Phoenix that was torn down? Was that from the 70s or more 80s?
I don't know that it was fully torn down. They like tore down a part of it, but I've written a lot of articles about, you know, mall related stuff. Because I don't know, I guess because I'm like Generation X, that's kind of a Generation X thing, is to write like about like pop culture, like in a kind of like, you know, like esoteric way like that, you know, like making, you know, things in pop culture or consumer culture, like making them like relate to some abstract thing or whatever.
Yeah,
but
so in a sense, it's, I mean, there's kind of an irony to it. It's not, there's sort of the whole kind of the hipster irony thing where these people say, oh, we're, or even the people who started Vaporwave, like, we're against consumerism, but we're going to take these old consumer logos and build a new aesthetic. But in your case, it's more authentic, but you're saying that you're someone who's critical of consumerism, but you're borrowing from these different things and, like, building upon it.
Yeah, well, it also goes back to what I talked about before, is that, like, you know, you just can't get away from this kind of stuff because it leaves such an impression on you. Like, you can't pretend to not be influenced by it or not think about this stuff. It's like, I think when, you know, that dude Chuck Klosterman, you know, like, he wrote about, like, how in the 80s, like, if you were a kid, like, that, you know, the Lakers versus Celtics rivalry, like, it meant so much more than basketball. Like, it totally defined, like, the kind of person, you know, that you were, like, what team that you cheered for, because it was, like, it was kind of deeper than that. Now you can, like, you know, sports ball, when we look at it now, we think, like, oh, it's, like, the most, like, vapid thing ever. You know, it's a total waste of time. It's like a distraction, and it, you know, it just it's just another avenue where they fleece you for money or whatnot. But you can't really deny the fact that, like, you may have been influenced by this stuff or by these movies or whatever that that have influenced you, and that's why they do have some value in terms of social commentary.
Can you talk about the lyrics for the songs and compare and contrast? A lot of the lyrics were taken from poems in your book, Beatnik Fascism. Can you give some examples and which ones were taken from the book?
Well, it's tough to say whether they were taken from the book or whether the book took them from, you know, lyrics that I already had, because a lot of these songs were songs that I had in my head for years and years. I don't necessarily record things right away. Like, when I get an idea, sometimes it will be in my head for 5 or 10 years before I finally sit down and say, like, you know, I'm going to try to figure out how to play this on guitar or something like that, and I'm just going to record it. But, you know, for the song For a Sunny Day was actually influenced by a band from the 60s called the Sun Rays, which was like a wannabe Beach Boys band. And they had a song called I Live for the Sun. So the song was kind of inspired by that. I wanted to make a song like that, but it, you know, it made it into my book, I think, because it also had, you know, just kind of like a just vaguely similar themes, you know, about getting out there and about the dangers and so forth. that's For a Sunny Day. And, you know, these songs, they don't really have any kind of, you know, seriously, like, identitarian themes or anything like that. But I think that if you look at them, you can see that, some of the psychology is the same. So you can see how, like, you know, Compare and Contrast, the song is really about, like, essentially, like, he's telling someone that, like, you know, that, yeah, like, he's basically, like, feels cornered in the world, but you know, maybe he'll be crushed, but, like, when you look back, you'll see that it was better, you know, like, so it doesn't really necessarily have these identitarian themes or whatever, but you can see how someone will have, like, a kind of a bunker mentality or something like that, that you can see the psychology translates to other aspects of life. Yeah, and, you know, Living Folklore, of course, is really, like, kind of a low-key, you know, like a battle song, really. Yeah, you know, but it could be a battle song for anything.
That was my favorite song. I like Living Folklore a lot. I thought I wrote on the Bandcamp page, I guess I'll quote it, quote, I said it was aesthetically pleasing music about Bo Tempe keyboards, ray gun gothic architecture, grainy 1960 commercials, and spacey bachelor pad music with an indie rock touch for fans of Late Talk Talk and Mark Hollis, Phantom Planet, Stereolab, and Majestic Lab Rat. And so I guess that was what I was thinking when I first heard the EP. I mean, you know, we have pictures in our head when we think about music, and I guess some of these songs really give out this kind of twee attitude to things. There's this very popular thing in the West Coast area where, you know, you have this generic vegan boyfriend, girlfriend with a tape recorder, and they go on their guitar and talk about how much they love life so much, right? I don't know if that's still a thing anymore, but I have some old tapes of that. But
right, like the Moldy Peaches and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like,
I know some indie labels like that. They're just way too obscure to mention, and it just seems like that is the trajectory over and over again. And I felt like some, other than the twee factor we could be talking about, I was more on the serious edge where, kind of like if you, in a John Cage aspect, that if you were to play a music in a giant room with reverb, you know, imagine like a Stanley Kubrick white room with Logan's Run, and then you hear, like, I really like that there's like, you know, this Bo Tempe that comes out, and it's just a solo for that right after doing the guitar, as to give more space or thinking, like it's a random record, like anything could possibly happen, or that there's a certain way to, you know, after hearing this part, it gives a certain, like, it is very futuristic music in a way. That's what I like hearing about it, and it focuses a lot on sound.
Well, I'm like a very minimalistic person, so I like minimalism in music. Both, like, I just like the emptiness of it, and I also like, I don't like the idea of ruining things by adding something. That's always like kind of a fear that I have, is that like you're going to add something on it, it's going to ruin it. You know, it's kind of when you're in the 90s and stuff, the late 90s, especially, like a lot of like pop music started to just like, it was all about like, you know, recording on like 24 tracks or 48 tracks, and they would just like layer all of this stuff. And I would just think like, you know, they're just layering, like, it's just too much stuff on it. And it's just like, it's ruining it by making the sound like too thick with all of these different instruments, because then you would listen to it and you would be like, gee, like the song would be good if it didn't have like, you know, all of this extra like electronic stuff just kind of like crammed in, you know, like.
When do you see as the peak of minimalism in music?
Well, the peak, I think that the peak has definitely long passed, because the stuff that's made now is definitely not not minimal. Although I don't think that, you know, I would say probably in the 90s with stuff like Daniel Johnston. I mean, it's literally like he has albums where it's just, he's recording songs with just vocals and nothing else. You know? So you have like, you have that stuff from the 90s, even some of like, you know, Boyd Rice kind of stuff that is very minimal and like the kind of anti-folk stuff. You don't see as much of that stuff anymore, but you can't really say that there's a peak or not, because now, like, there's just like a plethora, like everything in the world that you could possibly think of is being made now. It's just that, you know, it's not all being out there like for public consumption, in the sense that you have any idea where it is. Like anything you can probably imagine is probably like, you can probably find it on YouTube right now, but it's not.
But I was just, as we were talking about music, I was thinking, Brandon, there's this one label called Pop Gum Recordings, and it's basically, it's so indie, and it's basically like we were just talking about, where they just get these little plastic bags and make these strange, I'm not so sure if it's 1950s or 60s, but they make this weird, and it reminds me of your music, but I'd have to, I just want to reference that, because it came to my mind, Pop Gun Recordings. But
yeah, there's also a guy in Phoenix who was around even back then. And I just looked him up recently because I wondered about his name is Wayne Butane. And he makes these recordings that are just collages of weird records and things like that. And he has a really, a couple of really funny ones that was like Dead Monkey Arcade is one of them. And then he has one that's called Six Flags Over Auschwitz, where he like makes a collage out of like, you know, sounds from an old war record, and then also a like an advertisement record for Six Flags amusement park. And so he like mixes the two, and it's just like it's really well done for what it is, and he's still around.
Peter, do you want to talk about your review of Beatnik Fascism?
We actually, when there once was a Casper review, which is now called Flewland.
We did one on there already.
Yes, and Casper Review is the old name for Flewland, and now the podcast is defunct, but it's in the YouTube channel, and we had a special to advertise, and it was for Brandon Absom's Beatnik Fascism. And I remember talking about it and reading some poems aloud and talking about that certain aesthetic. And, I do believe when I first heard about Beatnik Fascism, it was actually on Robert Stark's show when it first came out. And I got the book because I liked that theme of the Twilight Zone. And the very sparse wording about, you know, talking about an alt-left and interesting wordplay on it. It pretty much has encouraged me to do my own poetry. I'm just very intimidated to do my own poetry because I'm not well-versed in poetry, and I find poetry a very esoteric tradition. I mean, I get haiku and the way that haiku sounds and looks. I find that, you know, European poetry is very daunting, and there's a lot to do from it. And I'm not so sure, to make sense of image text versus sounding text or lyrical. And, I always get this confusing today that the poets are made up of fine artists that prefer the English language on a piece of paper, right? And they have this weird fetish just for that. And but they're totally... Sometimes it might overlap with the fine arts or abstract painting of something you might see from Pollock, but the poets are really strange today because they feel like they could treat this abstract fine art but only express through words only, like a math sentence, which I find very strange. And that's why I always read science fiction pulps instead. So
we are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Brandon Adamson for being on. Check out his new album, Compare and Contrast. It's available on Bandcamp.
It's available on iTunes also.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice to talk to you guys, like always.
Action! Hop along onto my dream. We could be up to something, something, something free, something neat. Step right up and come and see something. When you double bounce me, space age springboard to a dream, something funner. Hop along onto my dream. We could be hit to something, something. Count the stars we could reach. Start the countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. When you double bounce me, space age springboard to a dream, something funner.